Okay, this is the 25th of March in 2019. And it seems a long, long time ago you've been involved in this market, actually doing business by publishing magazines yourself. And then you suddenly make a big, big move and you turned into the financial world. And you have been becoming very influential in this world. But it's not on me to talk about that. It's about you. That's why I make the interview. And you're going to present yourself first.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, as you said, I did start in magazine publishing. That was the first 10 years of my career, and loved it, and worked for three consumer magazines in the U.S. But while I was doing that, I was also involved in some M&A projects on behalf of those magazines, selling some of the operations, and I really, really liked that. So that took me in a different direction, and I joined an M&A specialist firm in New York and worked there for about 5 years, and then started my own firm 23 years ago with my co-founder. And we've grown the firm, you know, pretty substantially. When we started the firm, we were predominantly focused on magazines, consumer and B2B in the U.S., and there was a big market for that at the time. We quickly added digital media and have done digital media deals now for about 22 years. We also became experts in healthcare media. The biggest change, though, occurred for our company in 2008 in the financial downturn, and that caused us to shift away from magazines because the deal activity just wasn't anywhere near as strong as it had previously been. So we could no longer survive just being M&A experts in magazine publishing. So we shifted to advertising, marketing services, and information services. And those areas are all larger today than our practice in magazine publishing. We're still very active in media. We still are some areas like events that are still strong, but magazine publishing, we're very cautious about which assignments we take on because some of them are going to be extremely difficult to properly handle on behalf of clients.
I'm allowed to say that you helped some dinosaurs to survive and others to die quicker?
That's true. Yeah, that's very true. We sold a Parade magazine, and it's still being published now, but the time we sold it, it had a circulation of 32 million, so it was the largest circulation publication in the world. It was definitely in rapid decline by the time we sold it because advertising had gone down substantially, and it was primarily an advertising vehicle for Condé Nast. So we sold it to another media company that did something similar in the U.S. In terms of publishing a magazine that was distributed through newspapers. And that was the case with Parade. That's how the circulation got to be so large. It would be a Sunday supplement in a lot of major newspapers around the U.S.
We as journalists try to create value by content. You try to create value by M&A, by merger and acquisition. Is there any method, is there any line, is there any comprehension between these two worlds, or are they totally separate?
No, they're not separate at all. We can't do our M&A without the strong content. It makes all the difference in whether the publication's successful or not, whether it's a print publication or a digital publication. So strong content is incredibly important and a prominent factor in how much value there is in a property that we're selling.
Strong content is now meaning more and more strong personalities as well in this content world, or is it more the way how a whole world of a platform, of a magazine, of a journal is going to present itself?
It certainly can be strong personalities, but most importantly, it's just highly relevant content to the readers. So that they're either willing to pay for it or they're so attached to that source of content that advertisers want to reach that audience.
And this morning when you did your presentation, you had many people who confirmed that selling content in the online market is going to become more and more successful and going to be actually a source of revenue which is going to prevail. Can you underline the statement?
Yeah, I continue to believe that readers will pay for strong content, that excellent content that they can't get anywhere else. If it's straight news, I think that's harder because they can get the news from a lot of sources. If it's news with an opinion, you can't always get that. There's a publication in the U.S., Axios, and they provide news coverage, but they tell you how to think about it. And I think that model's really, really interesting. It is something that I think people were willing to pay for because it helps you to think through the news and put it in perspective.
This would mean that somebody like ProPublica, who presented its values and its way of presenting news, has to stay on a donation basis to survive?
Very good point, yeah. And I was briefly on, several years I was on the board of ProPublica's business advisory board. And I think it was set up as a nonprofit and it does rely on donations. And the belief is that news organizations like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times in the U.S. can't afford in today's world to spend tremendous amounts of money on investigative journalism. So ProPublica fills that void, but they do it through nonprofit status, and they then share their stories with for-profit publications like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. So they are really more of a cause-focused business and less of a news business. And they are very focused on exposing stories that wouldn't be written otherwise and have been incredibly effective. They've won now several Pulitzer Prizes in the U.S.
In your own story, you have lots of anchors in Europe. I wouldn't go into any detail. It's not part of this interview. But we as Europeans, what kind of lessons can we learn from what you do better than we have ever tried to do?
So I think it works both ways. The formula for publishing is a little bit different in the U.S. It's always been less dependent on newsstand, more dependent on subscriptions. And unfortunately, the U.S. went in the wrong direction. When the market got tough, they started practically giving away subscriptions to readers and charging far less than they could otherwise charge. Maybe a subscription's now, you know, $6.99 for 12 issues. And so they've moved really away from what was at one time their strength and have made their content be perceived as being cheap to readers and not really worth spending a lot of money on. And there are only, you know, a handful of magazines now that are charging a substantial amount, like The Economist. So that's been a problem. They had to then therefore rely more on advertising just at a time when advertising was shifting away from magazines and being with the market providing most of the ad revenue to Google, Facebook, and others.
So the last two questions will be a little more challenging. Tell me what you still want to really achieve after all this deal-making you've done so successfully.
Well, you're only as good as your last deal, so there's always an appetite to kind of work on the next deal. And every deal's different, and every deal can be challenging, and that's what's fun about it. It's fun to take on a project and see it all the way through and have a good outcome for the sellers.
So the last question is the most difficult one, because imagine all the questions I could have asked, but I didn't, because they would have been too many. Pick out one of these questions, which I haven't asked. Try to imagine it yourself and give an answer to that one.
Yeah, one question that I've only been asked, I think, once, but I think was a good question, was what was the most complicated deal that I ever worked on? And that was a deal early after starting our firm when we had a client come to us and say that there were seven owners of seven different businesses, and they wondered if they put all the businesses together, if they could sell them for a higher price than if they were to sell independently. And we agreed, yes, you could sell for a higher price, probably a substantially higher price, because it would be a much bigger business. You control 33% of the market in the United States. So we were advocates of doing that. And in fact, then the client decided, yes, let's do that. And it proved to be extremely challenging. We were successful, but we didn't anticipate all the challenges that would come up, including when we had a valuation from the buyer. We asked the buyer to give us 7 valuations for each of the individual properties, because we didn't want to be determined which owner got how much. We wanted the buyer to determine that. Even when we did that, there was some disagreement among the sellers who thought that their businesses were worth more than the buyer thought their businesses were worth. As a result, some of the sellers had to give up some economics to some of their other sellers to be able to get the deal done with all 7 parties. Otherwise, some of the parties would have dropped out, including some of the major publications that were an important part of the transaction.
So thank you very much for this last story about the 7 asset holders who finally got convinced by your method that they are more than just the addition of 1 to 7. So this is going to say that sometimes the evaluation of a digital asset may be even more value than an analog asset.
Yeah, are digital assets valued? Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you very much for all these insights, and I hope you have a safe trip home.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah.